about it. What can we do? What can we do about it? There's a lady in the office sitting next to me, running resolution fit for TV. On her desk she's got a 20-inch LCD, running maximum 640. What can we do? What can we do about it? What can we do? What can we do about it?
Right, welcome everybody. This is a bit loud.
Right, should we wear that?
Yeah, sure. I can mute it if I want to swear or something. Do you?
Okay, this is Andy Fitzsimon, and he's a graphic designer and Inkscape developer. They tell me a general pre-wear love child, you know. He comes from Brisbane, so we can forgive him for that. I can say that, I was born there. He's a developer of the Ubuntu icon theme, Human. He also develops artwork materials for translation at Red Hat APAC, and trained staff in the wonders of using Scribus, GIMP, and Inkscape. I wish I knew how to use Scribus and Inkscape. Last year, he presented an open source graphic design and was nominated to repeat his tutorial for a Best Of talk. He is an employee of Red Hat. So without further ado, let me introduce Andy, and let's see if we can get on.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I'm Andy, and yeah, I do open source graphic design is really the title for my job. But what I'm here to talk about is the workflow, the tool chain involved, and the way that by using open source software, you can actually create more valuable work not just for yourself, but for the rest of the world, maybe planning for the future of your business, but really I like the whole freedom idea as well, so I know what that. Who here has used Inkscape before, or? You haven't used Inkscape? Liar? again?
Yeah. With the lapel mic up a bit.
Hello.
Okay. Yeah?
Hook it to your shirt.
Hook it to my shirt.
Hook it in H.
Okay. Alright, good. Yeah.
So most of you know the difference between vector graphics. You're familiar with the SVG file format. I won't waste anybody's time by going through that. Okay, I covered a lot of that sort of stuff last year, so I'm going to skip through to a couple of projects that have eventuated outside of Inkscape and Creative Commons. I'm also going to go through some more nifty things for what's new in Inkscape. Then I'm also going to go through tool chaining, which is for anybody here who's not into graphic design, they really just want to get useful shit out of graphic designers. This is really sort of what you're going to want to look at. So I'm saying my monitor doesn't work on my laptop. I'm going to have to turn around and go through things. But I'll just load up Inkscape to give you guys a look at the interface since last year. Oh, look, pretty damn similar, which is great. The big change that's happened since Google Summer of Code of this year is we finally implemented the FE Gaussian Blur filter operation. So that's inside the XML for W3 spec, there's actually a way to blur objects. Last year I spoke to everybody and I said, Zara is so freaking cool, it can feather the edges of shapes. Well, we can actually blur entire groups now. Not to say that this is a competition, I just really think this is cool. Okay, so that effectively means we can blur any vector shape. The shape is still made up of lines, so we can actually manipulate a vector object, but not give it as much of a visual focus as you know, you usually have things in the background in vector illustrations, and they look crisp, which is a distraction for the eye, so we're trying to add that extra element for designers to play with. So yeah, for the uninitiated, SVG is XML. This is actually the definition of my filter in the XML, and then here's the property. So that's actually the rate at which we're operating. We've used, you know, 4.1%, but that's just to make sure that this is simple. Okay. So I'm going to go and show open clip art and what's actually happening with that, because I have the suspicion that there are a few people that are into PHP here, and I'm going to beg, and I'm going to whinge, and I'm going to try and get your time. So let's make sure that I use it usefully. Okay. Open Clip Art is actually a repository of illustrations, typically made with Inkscape, though not necessarily. It's a repository of vector illustrations that are licensed under the public domain. Reason being, the public domain is probably the most useful license. It means that somebody declares that they're going to release all copyright and intellectual property based on a work, and it just becomes part of what we can use. Very useful for clip art. No confusion, and considering the ways at which this is going to be used, that's the best. What's happened recently is we've migrated to another tool called CC Host. There's actually a website called CC Mixer. It's for DJs and remixing music, and people upload samples of their music. The RD3 tag stores the attribution of who created that sample, and then people can remix. So they might decide to make a track with samples of many people's different songs, and then they can remix together, and once they upload their work to the website, they can say, well, look, I used this, I use this, I use this. We think this is very useful for open clip art because derivative artwork may be one of the most appealing things about vector graphics. It's very simple to create more from what you've already got. So we've started a website up on openclipart.org, and we're trying to hack CC Host support into it. It actually uses PHP TEL for its templating engine, and mostly of what I'm focusing is getting it to look sexy. So this is the website now. You've got, you know, your login, you've got your, oh, it's going to be a bit messy. I won't show you it. Here's a mock-up, which is going to be a lot better, hopefully. Okay. So one of the good things about Inkscape is it's a great canvas. It's pretty fast. You can draw shapes, manipulate the size of shapes, not lose quality as you're messing around with proportion, size, color, and weight. And also you can do things like duplicate an object or duplicate a group of objects without changing at all, which means for websites, if you want to design your header here, you want to design maybe what a button looks like here, you can actually duplicate this, manage the illustration, the, you know, visual elements in one location, and then just mess around as you go, design 12 mock-up pages in one sort of go, vanishing in one area. And this is pretty useful. Okay. The whole idea of the remixing concept is that we can have pics on the front page. We've got RSS feeds for the news. You can sign in and submit. The whole idea is that the Open Clip Art Library is an archive of user-contributed illustrations freely placed into the public domain according to the statement by Creative Commons. So people are going to be submitting a lot of works. People are submitting a lot of works. What we need to do is actually make a good presentation ground for all of these and also allow people to see the contributions and the ways that they're making around each other. Say you've got a teacher teaching a class somewhere and they say, okay, kids, we're actually going to draw a vase with some flowers. And each child decides to make a different vase to have a different interpretation. When it comes to uploading, choosing the semantic data to mark these tags by, what's going to happen? They're all going to say vase, flowers, glass. Next thing you know, you're browsing through thousands of vases with flowers and glass. What might be good is to see which is related. Click on one and say, oh, that's a remix of these two. You know, find another and go, oh, okay, so maybe it's not marked up, but it's definitely a remix. So I'll go back down to the remixes view that we have. Okay, this is the browsing. Here we are. This is the administration mock-up for one of the dialogues. We've got an illustration that Michael has added in, and the admin has decided to make it a pic, so this means it ends up on the front page for about a week or so, or maybe it shuffles through. We still haven't decided. We have remixes, and we also have tutorials, so you can actually write a tutorial about how I did this, how I made this for a piece of work, which means you actually add more value. If somebody has a really cool thing, and you're like, man, it must have taken them hours, well, yeah, they've got a creative space to write, dude, it took me hours. Or, you know, no, it's actually pretty simple, which they'd probably say, but not really mean. So this remixes area actually shows people that have taken Michael's magnifying glass and they've actually played with the shape. So in this case, somebody's decided to delete all of the shiny specular shapes, add flat colors. Maybe they're concerned with just doing a letterhead for something. Maybe they just have run an accessibility concern where high contrast is important. So they've decided, okay, that's cool. Somebody loves pink and purple. That was me. I won't freely admit to loving pink and purple, but I did this for the purpose of the mock-up. And in Last FM style, we've got a chat box for people to comment on a piece of work. Really fast rating system. Just it shows you the existing rating. You hover over it. That's already implemented. A whole lot of cool stuff already in there. So enough with the preaching. I'm going to get to the useful bit about using Inkscape now. Okay. Notice how in each of these mock-ups, I'll switch to outline mode. Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
That's okay. All right. Sorry about that. Sorry, Og Fuhrer people. Okay. So in this mock-up for a website, we've actually got the header and the footer used a couple of times. We've got this logo here for Open Clipart. I'll go back into the normal display mode now. We've got this shape, which is white. It has a drop shadow. It's got a whole lot of things that are kind of useful. What happens if we want to melt? What happens if we want to melt this logo everywhere it exists? What's my CPU doing? Oh, that's good. Okay. You have to excuse the number of shapes that are in this. Yeah, okay, look at that. So the drop shadow for this shape is actually following the rest of that. Now, the reason being is I've just cloned that particular word library along with the other people in the group, Open Clip Art, and then I've duplicated it and I've applied a star to it, which means in the XML, this shape right here, this path, 5112, it actually has no style attribute, which is what Inkscape by default actually gives a fill black. I've gone in and I've deleted it just so that I can have this empty shape to refer to throughout the document. Also on top of that, in this first heading here, I've decided, in the first footer actually, I've decided that I don't want to redo this footer every single time. So if I change something in here, like I change the Open Clip Art logo, okay. Oh, yeah, that changed a lot. Say I want to delete all the hover links because I decided that maybe the underlines aren't so crash hot. Well, now down in all the other versions, what do you know, that first row of underlines isn't there. That's really cool. But what's even cooler is using a demo that doesn't contain 20,000 shapes. So I'm going to close out of this, and I'm going to go into the T-shirts that were designed for this conference. Plug. The T-shirts are actually using different colors. I went through a Pantone sweatbook and I picked out some colors for the printing. That didn't show up. I don't think anybody really minds. It's a distressed sort of look, so that's cool. This shape here, this will show you something interesting. When I sent to the printer the print file for these T-shirts, I actually said, I want this to be dead simple. I don't want the printer to stuff this up. I'm going to create two shapes. So there is no way that they could stuff up the printing. But for part of the style and the effect, I actually rotated gently the yellow bit of this text, and I rotated it so that it kind of gave a bit more contrast and a bit more feel towards the middle. The printers got the file, and they saw the rotated shape, and they thought, these pieces don't fit. Oh, we're going to mess up the printing. So they calibrated it for me, which is great. So if you ever come into something that might have a resize or a rotation, just write on a fly sheet, don't calibrate, please. But these two shapes are actually, these are also a group. So these are colored shapes in a group. I think the original, here we are. Okay, so say I wanted to melt the text for Sydney. Yeah, I wanted to make it really big. Notice on all the T-shirts, that's also changing. I just deleted the shape, That's really cool to play with. Well, that's why I wanted to mess with the colors. I didn't want to mess with the design. Inside here, these two shapes here, you actually notice that, wow, those are all the vectors. Those are all the node points inside the one shape. What that means
is when you're drawing, so you've got two shapes here. I've got two separately managed elements. They're also two separate shapes inside the XML. You can go through the path menu and you can union them, you can combine them, both will make it the same shape. This will actually generate a Boolean operand against it so that they actually redraw against each other, so you might have some lossy effect there. So now they're the one shape. Now what I can do is if I remove all the formatting, that's just deleting that, I can blur this shape. I can give it a particular color. And now I can do changes to this, which actually affects the shape below. That's useful. And I'm going to talk about tool chaining. And I'm going to talk about why doing that sort of design once, deploy everywhere method of free graphic design. And that's really good when it comes to internationalization. It's really good when it comes to creating custom illustrations and managing them everywhere. But the particular favorite of mine is making sure that when you design a piece of artwork or when you're doing a technical diagram, that it is working in every single language. And that's a hidden power of using an XML-based file format. Now, most people here are familiar with software development, like upstream, you know, your different derivatives, and then you've actually got, you know, maybe a base level. Well, really, this is the whole idea, is to get graphics to have SVG upstream when you're talking about illustrations. This means that for publishing geeks, you would absolutely know what I'm talking about. You would know that you have a single format, you know, you might have it might be a Photoshop file or an Adobe Illustrator file, and then you export from that to, you know, PDF, you might export from that to a flat file on the web, you might have a tool chain that connects these pieces together. So the whole idea is that SVG is your upstream, and then you're actually just publishing to different areas. I'm going to show why that's a bit interesting. Okay. Here is about 600 or so little illustrations for technical diagrams, technical documentations. I've got to tell you, they're not pretty because it takes, you know, like you just have to storm through them. There are so many. And what sucks is now that you're putting these sorts of things in a book, this is like shared storage, clustering. Yeah, this is clustering stuff. But anyway, what really sucks is if you're publishing a book, a technical document about your project, and suddenly your major customer or the major contributions coming from your project are based in China, well, you're going to have to redo every single one of these, and that's not cool, especially since you've actually just put that string of text in there each time. So you've just typed in the word, you know, Oracle RSC, or you've just typed in the word, you know, Golem or whatever node. That's all well and good. The benefit of having those in SVG means that there's one T span or one text area that says this is the text string. Everything else around there is just flat shapes. I'm going to give an example about the effects and also about the translation process using known utils. So, translate. Oh. Whoa. Okay. Chrome.svg. I figured this talk could mostly be about bling, so I've got this. Cool. Maintainable designer graphics. This is a Chrome effect that I've actually made by doing different gradient effects and a tiny bit of blurring. So notice there's that little water bit underneath. That's a duplicate. That's a clone. When I'm talking about clones, I really skipped over this. When you have any object selected, you can go Object. Oh, hang on. Isn't it an Edit? Oops. Edit Clone. So you can create clone. You can unlink a clone, which means that it's no longer a copy. Once you unlink a clone, it's just a duplicate. The difference between a clone and a duplicate is I've drawn this shape. Now I'd like this same shape, and I'm going to modify it. A clone is I want it to stay the same as my original. And that's an important thing to do when you're designing. So, notice how I've just got two different effects here. I've got one layer which is a fill gradient going upwards, and then I've got another layer which is a stroke which has a gradient going down. And also at the back, I've got a little chromey gradient thing there, and that's giving me the background for my shape. So that's all a clone. Each one of those shapes, all they are in the XML, is that they refer to this shape, this ID. Actually, this is funny because this is actually referring to a reference. it's like a clone of a clone. You can clone groups of clones and groups of groups of, and you know, it gets kind of messy and your brain breaks. But what you can't do, and I tried this for the chrome effect, I was like, oh cool, so we've got the reflection on the floor of the chrome. Okay, now I'm going to put, because I duplicated a clone and I made a group of two clones, and I reflected on the floor and masked it so that it looked like a shadow. And then I went, wait a minute, it's metallic. I'm going to have to put the reflection inside the original shape. So I've duplicated and I want to put it inside the original shape. It crashes, but it's, if you ever get yourself thinking that I should make a duplicate inside a duplicate inside a duplicate, don't put it inside the group. You don't have to. Stick it on top and drop the opacity down. You're an absolute nutcase if you think that you can put things inside, inside, inside. But I'm sure there's a way to handle it, and I'm sure I should file a bug. Bully would hurt me. Okay. So when I mentioned this is going to be in the tutorial files, what I mentioned is this is one string of text. So that chrome effect, well, that's way too long, and I'm going to cover this as well. You can notice that the reflection at the bottom, you can notice that the flare, which is just one shape, forget that. I put the flare in the middle because I figured I don't know where it's going to land on each individual character, and I can't map it to where text is, so I'm just going to stick it there. But it's really cool. This means if you run a website and you have a particular brand guide, you have a particular aesthetic that you need to communicate across, so maybe you like big red and black and bold statements, well then you're going to have to set that out as a parameter of style, have some text, and then mess with it, you know, mess with the input. So you can maintain the logo on your website across several different languages because of this, or several different statements. You might want to hook it into Fortune and have something cool and real bling text. You know, maybe it's like Hitchhiker's quotes or something, you know, it just looks cool. And the same thing with this text underneath. I've just duplicated the shape twice. On the back, I've blurred out the text. I've blurred out a black piece, and on the front, I've just made white solid. So that means that I can mess with the string of text. That's kind of neat. So what I had before is I actually had, well, besides the gobbledygook, I had cool, maintainable designer graphics. I'm in a fortunate position to work with a lot of translators. So what I decided to do for this tutorial is translate that string of text, not the JS head, what I had originally. I'm going to translate that string of text into any particular language. And the great thing about human beings is they actually get what a word like cool or designer graphics. So, you know, no one really understands designer because you might be thinking, oh, well constructed. You're actually thinking, no, custom. Like, you know, it's meant to be appealing. There's plenty of languages that don't have equivalent words, so you've got to get a human to interpret them. One thing that you have to wonder about is that not every translator really wants to learn Inkscape. Most translators actually just want to use the tools that they're doing and shut Andy up because it's lunch and they want to go. So what I had to think about is how do I get this into a PO file? How do I get this into a file that translators can digest and send back to me? So I really needed to make it as easy as possible for their workflow so that just like they translate a technical book made in DocBook converted to PO, they need to be able to do the same for documents and diagrams. So I tried for ages, and I made other people try for ages too, much longer than me, and I'm sorry. But I tried for a long time to write a script that would hack out where the text is, and at one stage I was doing the same sort of thing with Scriber's file, so we had a Perl script called SLA2PO, and then GNOME DocuTools drops. Someone said, I think on Pounding Step, was why don't you just use, GNOME DocuTools? I'm like, you can do that? But yeah, you can do that. Check this out. I've got PO files for German, Chinese, Brazilian, Korean, Russian, and Spanish. Everyone else was either too busy or too smart to translate for me. What I wrote here, also my ITN tool chain, which is, you kind of have to put it on the stick, it's pretty much just four procedures for translating a document. XML to PO, dash A, dash O, input file, so you make sure that you've got an SVG file, POT, and then you make, this is a PO file on the first string, and then the SVG file on the second string. Then you copy the SVG file to Lang. When I copy the PO file to Lang, it's effectively, if you're a sysadmin, you're copying it to every single language you want to maintain. So
So you would copy it to awesome-diagram-kr, you know, Korean. Awesome-diagram-jajp for Japanese. Awesome-diagram, you know, dash, you know, sp, enus, all sorts of things. Enus, engb, enau. Maybe if the statement cool needs to be translated locally within English to English, someone might say blimey, and you want to say awesome, you know, like it's different, but you can actually go to that level of translation, use it in some nice ways. So this actually, I've already done the these two lines for us, and I haven't got Kbabel installed because it isn't in Fedora Extras, but Kbabel is, if you're not familiar with it, it's the preferred PO file editor for a lot of translators doing open source work. There is an equivalent which is nice. I don't notice the difference at all, but apparently there is. So for long-term translation, open up in Kbabel. Then you copy it back. So what I'll have a look at is this is my original PO file. Okay, this is a PO file that got generated. Now, it actually says SVG301.txt, so this is actually listing where in the XML file it is. And then it just gives me a message string. So here, unfortunately, I forgot to hack out the image SVG. If they translate that, we're dead. I could crop that, but it was the way I made my documents. So this statement here, cool, maintainable designer graphics, and then translator credits. Translator credits is just attribution to whoever made the hack on the PO file. So that's not actually going to be used, but it is somewhere to make sure that you know who's a good translator with this, or who's a bad translator. They put their email address there. It's kind of cool. What language does anyone want to see? Russian? You want to see Yulia stuff? Cool. Okay, well that's cool because there's really nice Cyrillic font. Okay, so this is Chinese. Cool. Translation, maintainable designer graphics, translation, translator credits. Considering I only know bad English and worse English, it's good to have people do your translation for you. Especially when you're a designer, other people are professional content authors, and then there are people who are professional translators, okay? Everybody's going to do their bit. So if you've got somebody who sketches out a really hacky job of a diagram, it's then my job to make sure that that hacky diagram is in brand and in focus. One thing I mentioned before about those diagrams is SVG is an XML-based file format with style sheets, which means we can abstract the style of maybe a commercial entity. We can say, okay, instead of being red for everything, we're going to make it blue, or instead of having some sort of silver text everywhere, you can actually put a corporate palette or corporate design elements, maybe a pattern somewhere, and you can customize a whole range, thousands and thousands of illustrations, so that you might make a book for your partner. You know, you might sell under this brand, you might have like, you know, Ubuntu, Kubuntu, Enterprise Linux, Fedora, you know, whatever. You might have a pair of product suites and you want to be able to give them the same documentation. This is a really useful thing because you have style sheets to do this. And then you can translate them. So what's really great is that as long as the technical concept of a diagram or something doesn't change, you can effectively maintain it throughout the evolution of your company. You know, you might not be so immersed in having sexy graphics now, but what happens after you get acquired? What happens after, you know, yeah, what happens, yeah, when Web 3.0 says, oh, devils and the bosses are out, you know, flat graphics are in. Yeah. and what the hell? Why have you got this water shadow? Turn it off. You can turn it off, you know, pretend it never happened. The XML will still reference the coin of the shape, so they might see some relics in it. Anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to nick the string of text because I'm too lazy to copy because I'm a graphics guy. Okay. Lang.po. So it's called Chrome Russian. ChromeRussian.po. Okay, that's my language. And then SVG file lang. So I'm just going to call it ChromeRussian.svg. Now, if you are really good at writing for loops or you're like some server dude, you probably would automate this in a much more sane way. And this is svgfile.po, so I'm going to chrome.po. I think I've made it POT, but I'll just keep chrome.po. Did I get an error? Is that an error? No, it's not. Check it out. What? Huh. He's Korean. Yeah! Yeah, well, that works. I don't know why I messed up, but I'm not going to spend more time on it. The whole idea of translating your graphics is that now, when you're designing, you need to be considerate of those sorts of things that are going to happen. I know that it might be really cool when you have a box that's really, like, this wide, and you've actually written, this is a really cool box, and then it gets translated to simplified Chinese, and they go, like that. That's not bad. What's bad is when you write server cluster, and then German or Brazilian Portuguese go, server cluster, and it is actually a cluster of computers that are written together, and, you know, like, it's just big, long strings of text. What the problem is that with SVG, you're floating strings of text in a space with just, you know, an XY, and you might not have other design elements, be a box around it, or there might be a label, you might have objects too good close next to each other. You've got to be considerate for this stuff. So I'm going to show you some stuff to do with line breaking and some stuff to do with flowing text around shapes and whatnot, just so that you get the idea. Who actually is interested in the whole IATM thing, the whole making your graphics last forever, no? Yep. Okay, well, so maybe I should just do some cool blingy stuff. Yo, you had a question? Okay. You're actually talking, okay, that's cool. Yeah. Alright, this is where everything went. What the hell? It's invisible. What's this?
The barrel bug?
Wow, there. Oh, it's all back. Okay, yeah, so back to open clip art. Yeah, we really need someone to hack for us. Both librarians and also people hacking on the PHP, yeah, the tag cloud. Except we have system tags. System tags is where we decide, okay, so this is clip art, which means that if somebody decides to grab a file, you know, and the metadata should reflect where it came from. Open clip art library should also reflect the fact that it is clip art. We want to keep this semantic data that the system otherwise would know about, you know, together. It's cool. All right. Open up Inkscape. Fresh start, fresh canvas. We might have a box. Might be beveled. Doesn't have to be anything. And we have text. Okay, so we have a really light box and dark text. And this text here, right now, all it is in the XML is a T-span, right? Yeah, it's just a T-span. And that means that it's got a coordinate, and all it is one long line. We have different style properties that we can apply to it, centered left to line, right align. Now here's the problem, look how much it moves. Imagine you're a right to left language. Or, you know, imagine you're talking about a center point, you know. It's going to mess up. It's going to really suck. So the best thing is to be able to give a bounding box to your text or give it a shape to flow around. This means that although you may enjoy that white space, other people may desperately need it to see the next line of text. What happens now with the text tool in Inkscape, I think it's 4.4 has it as well, right? There. Okay, never mind. Okay. What happens is you can just actually just click and drag. Click and drag creates, forget what it's doing to the SVG, just forget about it. It's very messy, but hey. You can write text, it can flow to the next frame. It can flow to the next line, which means that within this particular shape here, all of those operations don't hurt anybody. Which means if you're defining a shape and you need this text to sort of operate around it, that's kind of useful. Also, if you have, now I always don't encourage the whole idea of having large amounts of text inside an illustration, because illustrations are for pictures. You're, you know, communicating a concept or you're drawing something pretty. If you're trying to write a book, use DocBook. Use something nice, because this is where it gets tricky. Say you want text to flow around this shape because this shape is a really important shape. Well, I'm just going to draw a couple of rectangles. There's one. There's another one, and here's another one here. All right. I'm going to unify them. and I'm going to select both the text on top of the shape and the shape below, and I'm going to go flow into frame. So now, when I type, I'll just copy and paste all of that. It fills around the shape, which is really quite neat. And there are many hacks that you can see the shape being changed actually affects this. And you can build it out. There you go. It flows out. That's really handy if you need to define a particular area. Make sure that there's enough room for it to flow through. And even turn these objects' visibility off. So you can actually turn in the style. Oh, actually, I'll show you through the dialogue. Yeah. Just make the opacity 0. So you've got this flow of text, but, you know, no actual visible need to worry about what's there. So I'm going to go on to desktop stuff, desktop artwork, desktop icons, and tool chaining for the future desktop, and what can we do with the desktop. But I'll take questions now about stuff, if anyone's got a question about Inkscape. No questions? Oh,
what does that do with the SVG?
Yeah, you really don't want a cell phone. No, it's not. It does populate, if you're messing around for too long on a particular shape in Inkscape, you're polluting the style property, but that's it. So you're polluting the style property, but unlike HTML authoring editors, you're not generating unnecessary elements. Every element is necessary to get the document to be viewed. And the funny thing about it is it's a visual language, but it also has extensibility in the range of style. So every object that you do is normally there for a reason, unless you draw something, pull the opacity down, and forget about it. And then it is there for a reason, to remember you drew it. You know, and that's kind of useful. But yes, when you create an object, usually Inkscape gives it a style property first. So the trick I showed about cloning an object and then just making duplicates of that clone and then applying style properties, when you first create an object, and this is a bug that a lot of people come into, when you first create an object, say I'm going to draw some invisible text. Okay, I'm going to actually fill this because it's remembered my last style, which is a behavior I prefer, but it's not turned on by default. I can duplicate this, and now all of the properties that are listed here now come predominantly from the parent. I can't overwrite them by applying future styles in here. So I can do things like blurring because that's actually a new property. But if I blur this, okay, it'll blur on top because it's a blur is a different sort of value. But if I change this to pink, yeah, the child changes to pink as well. And that means that the best idea for if you're preserving a shape or preserving an area is just Control Shift X, you're into the XML editor, which I promise is getting better, and it delete the style field, which is, you know, fairly cool. Questions again? Everything but Gaussian blur. So the blur currently isn't, but we've just created a stable branch of SVN for the release. We also have binaries on Inkscape.org, so you can actually download a thrice daily build for your platform if you're a Windows user or something, and you know you can get it now. And I recommend getting it. I think it's in a usable state. We have a policy of keeping chunk up to a stable, always usable state, which is adhered to 98% of the time.
So has everything you've shown
used since 2024? No. The creating a clone and making sure that you manage it, that's actually the use element, which is an SVG element which has been around since 3.8. You know, a long time, and that's in there. And so is, you know, the other effects that you can do. Flow text is also there in 4.4.4.3 headed, I think. You know, it's all there except for blurring. Blurring is so useful, I recommend everybody grab the latest build they can. Distros aren't currently shipping it, but... Okay, next question. Yeah.
Is there any way to delete the style property without having to go into the XML editor?
Yes, but not all of them. Okay, so... In the fill and stroke dialogue, we actually have this question mark, right? Unset paint, make it undefinable so that it can be inherited, which, yeah. And also the same for stroke, But what you won't notice is things like your text, your font. If you're using, like, you know, you're copying some text and you want to change the font, oh, that's cool. You can actually grab text and then you can, like, you know, see how the same, you know, paragraph of text looks in 12 different fonts. You know, but you're actually just using the one body of text. Your SVG file is this big. And that's, you know, one of the advantages. But, yeah, you can't unset everything, which is why I recommend the XML editor, just because it gives you a direct view of everything that's there in your original parent. Okay.
That's Has that been reported as a bug, that you have to go to the SVG editor to delete all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. But we all know it is. We, like, as in, the text editor is getting revision at the moment, and hopefully unset style is going to be one of the things. And it's going to be a property-by-property chase. So each time there's a style property assigned to an object, we're going to have to chase it down and make sure that there is an unset area. But the thing is, unset style is only relevant to sort of the style it's applying. So we can only replace it, you know, like in the film stroke dialogue and the text dialogue, or in the gradient dialogue, it's, you know, well, it's part of the film. So, yeah, that answered your question. No more other questions?
Store the SVGs and version control. You don't have version control. The rest of the stuff gets built from that.
Yeah. So with publishing, actually, with Diagram publishing, there is this is the workflow for translation or publishing to do with document and text. Yeah, the SVG is stored in a repository, but the other formats aren't. They're generated on build. And one script that we run is we export all. And I'll actually have to grab the USB file back so I can copy some just, you know, for loops that I do. And one of them is export every SVG file here at its current size as a PNG, then apply a PNG crush because it's obviously for the web, then put it out into the web directory. And this is done through the same set of procedures as FOP generates, or XML2 generates the HTML. So if you're familiar with XML2, it makes DocBook into HTML, and you can do some stuff to hack it around to make it look cool.
Can you quickly show us some gradient soup, because I just don't grok how to tweak gradient.
Okay, certainly, sure. Okay, what's the time have we got, like, sweet, all right, cool, all right. All right, gradient soup. One thing that I haven't, and a patch that I should have applied this morning, is we have multi-stop editing of gradients on Canvas currently as a patch. So what that means is, I'll just click everything and delete it. What that means is we create a gradient here. We decide to add blue in the middle. We can actually see on Canvas, which I can't show you right now, just another square. And that square allows me to set the offset of the color. And also, when I have a dot selected, you might notice this. Notice the fill and stroke area only chooses to acknowledge one point. So this is the alpha is set to 0 on this. So what happens is each time we click on one of these dots, we're changing one of the values of each stop. The multi-stop support on Canvas, which is in a patch right now, means that we can click on the middle stop. And we can actually give them a color. And then, on top of that, we can drag them towards the start point or the end point to give them this offset. And this offset is actually something that I think we should provide for both start and finish points. Notice how offset is grayed out for the start and finish? Well, if you're doing something, and I'll give you a quick example of a sphere-like tutorial. Okay. I'm just doing that. Oops. I'm just going to do the quick way of doing this gradient. I want to set the inside to be 0. I want to set the outside, but I actually want it to be more of a sharper drop in the gradient. So what I have to do in this particular case is create a new one from Inkset Workflow and set it up to there. See how I provide an offset of 0.7? Well, that offset could be set by the original point. So in the XML for a gradient, which I'm not suggesting you edit gradients through XML editor, but in some cases in control design, it's necessary. Okay, so we're going to definitions. The gradient I've created is 6161, real gradient 6161. That refers to linear gradient 6161. Okay. Linear gradient 6161. Inside that, we have our multiple stops. What we should be able to do is give this offset, which is set to 0, 0.7. Inkscape does render it properly. It's just a bug. But that's why when I suggest creating a third stop to set the offset, that happens. Hopefully we're going to fix this. But right now the coolest thing in gradient land is patches. The patch with the multi-stop is like sweet. Okay, back to gradients. This is the center point of a radial gradient. So if you actually go to the fill and stroke dialog and select the difference, you've got linear and radial. The difference between linear is it goes in one direction. Whereas radial, you actually have, you know, sort of an area to fill it out with. With radial, we can do two things. We can set the center point of the gradient, and we can also set the center point offset. And now the center point offset is done actually by holding shift when you click. So you hold shift on the center point, and you click and drag from the center, and that will give you this offset, and then you can control it just by clicking it. But that offset is great. It's particularly great for the inverse of what I just showed you by providing base shadows, really simple illustrations of base shadows. So you might want, there you go, you've got a horizon line. So that sort of thing, pop lines are there, you know. So that's really cool. No worries. Any more questions? I'm going to go into desktop artwork, icons, illustration. Okay, cool. A while ago, there still is, and there still is a great debate about vector icons, which I can't believe you can actually debate about vector icons, but the whole idea of vector being resolution independent made people give some immediate assumptions about that means that it looks great at any particular size. No, that's not true. In the same case for fonts, you actually need to hint a shape for a particular size. This means so that at really small scales, pixels actually get little outlines, sharp edges, making sure that if you might have a highlight on the first inset, it means that you've got some contrast. It's both an accessible and aesthetic thing. I'll give you an example because it sounds like I'm brushing over it. So in a popular icon set called the Tango Project, there is actually this notion of having an outside stroke matching part of the palette to a darker variant of what palette is the majority of the shape. And you've also got an inset highlight stroke. I think it's called a pinstripe, not a wind stripe. No, sorry, a wind stripe, not a pinstripe. Okay, here's a Tango palette. So what this means that at, and this is, I should have turned the filtering off, but at 1 pixel by 1 pixel, which you won't be able to identify here, you have dark, one solid dark line on the outside border and one solid light line contrasting on the inside border. This means that at that particular scale, it looks great. It looks sharp and crisp. One of the problems you have, and I just go to select stroke, is that at a really large scale, you compare that with your OS X style icon, it actually looks a bit chunky, heavy, because it's being designed for this really sharp size. So although it is vector, it isn't hinted for that particular scale. So we've got fans of bitmap authoring for icons going, oh, the bitmap is the way, and then you've got people who are saying, but vector is scalable, you know, we want one file, we want single source, you know, so that's a bit of controversy. The great thing about this is that there is 1,000 solutions. And the best one of all, my personal favorite, is style sheets, because style sheets can affect things like the stroke, the fill, the color, the opacity. You can apply filter properties if you have that defined in the document. So what that means is, and this is like a live demo of it, I'm going to turn off scaling and stroke, which means that I'm going to decide on the style sheet that if this is being displayed at a high size, now imagine this, because I'll show you the code later, then the stroke will follow. So when I click and drag, notice the stroke actually stays 1 pixel. You've got a shape inside the middle, and that hangs around. Now, the reason how I've done this is I've done the same duplication technique. I've duplicated the outside outline of that trash can, and I've masked it against itself. So that what I mean by masking it against itself is I've grabbed the outline of a trash can, and then I've painted it black with a fat stroke. And I've grabbed that shape again, and then I've painted it black over that other black stroke. And I've said, mask me, clip me. I'm going to show you what a clip mask is. Clip mask is when you actually say, I only want this object here to appear within the object on top. So I go clip, set, which means, see how I've got this shape here? Well, it actually only appears within that shape. So I can now apply transformations to it, but it's constrained by the original shape. So that's a way that I've decided to implement in the XML this clipping of the stroke, so that it always tracks depending on the size that I give it. And then in the style sheet, I've said, okay, here's a class, and this class is for a stroke highlight. And for this case, for this particular size, the class is 50% opacity stroke white. Now, this is probably confusing as hell, and I'm sorry, but you really can't get simpler than pixels, you know? This is hacking vector files so that we maintain one file for multiple sizes, and we can also transcend the aesthetic as much as possible. Question?
So if you have a different CSS or file sheet for each size, or
for
one file sheet for each
size? The great thing is, yeah, you can have a style sheet for each size. That's generally the idea for this. There's also the media property, which you can actually use as well in the style sheet. So you can actually say within the one style sheet, at this size, at this size, at this size. But when it comes to desktops, fortunately, because of the pixel, they've already created folders, 16, 128 by 128, 48 by 48, and all you have to do is symlink the vector files and then just have, you know, a CSS file for that resolution in the directory. But I'll show you what I mean. This is the exact same SVG file, these here. You've got a high contrast one, you've got one that actually contains no stroking whatsoever, and more opacity on the drop shadow. You've got one that has the Tango style, you've got one that has the known palette, you've got one that has a screen. We've done the same thing with the Inkscape logo. This is a duck that caused the great crash of Inkscape. You know, the duck freons, the solution of... Okay, well, there's a preferences file. When you open up an Inkscape document, your preferences file grabs, you know, your properties, and actually I polluted the header of every person who opens up this file for the future of their using Inkscape, which we fixed, but it was kind of funny to have a virus that was unintended specific to people who've opened up one file, and it's only one build of Inkscape, and it caused hell. OpenClipArt had to withdraw a whole lot of contributions because of this mess up, because it, you know, invalidated the XML of the SVG. All right. So I'm going to go through one of these. I might as well go through the Inkscape logo. Why not? Open with text editor. Okay. Confusing as hell. But this area here is where I've injected the style sheet, because currently Inkscape doesn't support external styles. Inkscape, the authoring tool, doesn't support external styles, but RSVG, the GNOME interpreter for vector graphics, does, which is good. But here, Inkscape does render this embedment of style. That means I've decided to go, okay, outline big, outline small, still none, opacity 0.1, 0.2. In this case, I'm actually making them non-existent. I've turned the opacity down to such a low level that they're not even noticeable. This is before blur, so what I did is I actually gave them two steps of size and, you know, changed the opacity down per step. Stroke highlight, I've given that no stroke, no fill. Stroke none, opacity fill none. See, these are all turned off in the style sheet because I've decided to have a borderless style. So here's what black is according to the palette. Here's what white is according to the palette. This is full specularity. Now, I've created a gradient on a shape at white to not white, so 1 to 0, and that gradient's defined up here, white to transparent. And then what I've actually classed to the shape that has that gradient as specularity, full, and I've decided on a couple of levels, full specularity, medium specularity, low specularity, and then there's also shade. So all that means, for people that you know, really want to just follow this quick is I've made two classes, one for gradients I intend to be black to nothing, and ones that I intend for white to nothing, so that across different aesthetics, different look and feel for different desktops or different devices, I can say, all right, I want this to be whole, so shiny. I want this to be so dark, deep looking. And that's the difference. So I'll go back to another file. In this particular case, for the trash can, they're actually a fairly similar palette. But what I've done is I've turned off the stroke and I've turned up the specularity. So you don't notice, but inside this trash can here, these shapes here, so this particular one, this particular one, this particular one, and this particular one, they're all of a set opacity. This is a set level of transparency so that they behave in a certain way. I can turn them all up to full, you know, really bling it out, but I choose in the style sheet to give each different aesthetic a different value. And this is a silly thing to think of. This is me thinking of what is the Windows style, what is the OS X style, what is the GNOME style, and what's the embedded platform style. Now, the advantage of this is what happens when we start thinking on the desktop scale, what is the taskbar icon style? Is it just one pixel, black outlines? Is it gray? Is it muted? Not something you can do with post effects like desaturate. You know, you actually have to set around or know the shapes to define these properties. So this is kind of cool. This is, means that we go to a new level of thinking. Right now, GNOME supports it. Inkscape doesn't support it as an authoring tool, so therefore we see very few contributions, well, we see very none contributions to icon sets that contain this workflow, this tool chain. That's something that should be thought about, something that's actually being hacked on. I don't have a suggestion for it, but what I'm saying is that this technology supports ways to transcend aesthetic across different look and feel. You can design once, draw a picture of a smiley face, upload it on OpenClipArt, have somebody else go through and go, oh, wow, I can actually hack this around. And I'm going to, yeah. You can have somebody hack around a particular shape or a file and then recommit it. It might be useful to them, but they just don't know what changes to make. So this is an automated way of making those changes. I showed you the remixing part of OpenClipArt, so you can actually make these changes through the tool by just, okay, drag the shape out one by one, you know. And also you've got tool chains for internationalization. So any questions about that? It sounds like crazy crack, and it is. But it's basically pushing the limits of how far you can grab these assets and how useful you can make them. So it's sort of like I've made a picture of a duck, which I don't think is so shiny, and someone says, well, it's a nice duck, but it ain't shiny. You know, so I've given them the facility by creating these shapes with a class specularizer full up. Kind of like a micro format, which is like some sort of Web 2.0 buzz thing right now. Well, kind of like a micro format for SVG documents, you know, so you've got it all. And I need to spec that out, which, you know, is still getting so little attention that I probably won't yet. But any questions about desktop artwork, desktop icons, illustration, any needs for tips? No?
The remixes that you showed are remixes. Well, is each remix a complete new independent copy of original?
Now, because I told you how crackful the workflow was of abstracting the style sheet completely from your document, your SVG document, when I went through the GED, it actually didn't, I forgot to show each one of the paths and each one of the creations of copies have no style applied. They had just a class, empty. So if I were to take out the style sheet, everything would be black. And that's because no properties, nothing is filling. So the default SVG renderer would give it nothing but black. With OpenClipArt, that's a different kettle of fish. That's actually, somebody can grab a file, open it up in Inkscape, and change it how they want, and then recontribute that. That actually adds a human aspect, which I think is the best part of originality. You can actually get somebody saying, that's a good tree, but I would have drawn it more like this.
That's extending your original, not one.
Yeah, so this is actually copying the file physically, creating a different file by remixing it. It might not even involve that file whatsoever. It might be an idea. It might be you have had a look at something and thought, well, I will draw it like this. And because you actually can't say, this is an original work, you can actually go, well, hang on a tick. I did grab it from this person's idea. I wouldn't have even drawn a USB pen stick, you know, out of my own free will without seeing somebody do it and thinking I could have a crack. I could do one better, or I could, you know, make it more useful for people that prefer this. That's the idea. That's the that's the open clip art philosophy for remixing. And the funny thing is, that was just a feature that CC Mixter had in their web software, and it's actually turned out really well. So CC Mixter allowed this to happen for very practical reasons. People provided samples, and people do remix music. We're familiar with the concept. With Open Clip Art, we just needed a CMS for storing and cataloging the clip art, the actual independent illustrations. But having a look at how we can track the way that remixes are done, it means that somebody might trace, do a vector trace of a horizon, and then somebody might decide to add some nice touches, some gradients, some shading, some color. People might want to mess with the palette. They might go, oh, I love Boston in, you know, autumn, or, you know, but I prefer it in summer. You know, so people can actually grab the same image, mess with it, and then upload it. And these tracks, these are visually tracked for us. We can see the derivatives being made. And it creates communities. It creates people that will write a tutorial about how they change somebody else's work. And because in Open Clip Art's case, it's all public domain, this means that everything is that useful. Now, I'm not suggesting for all projects, if you're doing an artwork project, that public domain is the best license. I prefer CC attribution share alike. But when it's something with as little effort as creating one little picture, I think you can wing the idea of giving it away for free. You know, you might have used it for a party invite or something. Now it's the rest of the world. That's a great thing. I got an email from somebody saying, my son's having his birthday. Could you please draw a picture of a mobile phone, a web browser, and an email? And I'm more like, you're running a proprietary software, aren't you? You're just getting me to draw your icons. And it's like, no, this is for my son. It's his 7th birthday. So I didn't actually respond to that. If you're the son, I'm sorry. But it's that sort of thing. People can grab stuff that's useful for only that time. It's a very temporary need. So therefore, people aren't focused on creating something. They want a quick resource. Yeah.
Is there any chance that you plan to integrate Inkscape closer to Open Clip Art, like a file published to Open Clip Art, so you can make it easier?
And currently we do. And I'm going to show the document properties, the metadata error. This used to be, if you're running an older version of Inkscape, it will still be in the document properties dialog. This has been a long implemented thing that John Phillips added. This is the entities that you can add. This injects an RDF set of XML to define the keywords, the language, the relation, the source, identifier, publisher. This is just RDF stuff for, hey, I made this, you know? Hey, I made this, make it useful in these many ways. Now, we're trying to make it very useful to tag and to remix this sort of stuff. And so, yeah, within Inkscape, you can add all this information. We actually think that maybe it might be more useful in the file save properties dialog. Like, so when you file save, you can go, oh, hang on, send this one to Open Clip Art. Right now, we haven't added that functionality to Open Clip Art. We need to add that functionality to both Inkscape and Open Clip Art. If you're into XML RPC and all that cool, crazy crap, please come and hack on it. It's great fun. And that would add so much more. We have people using this software, doing stuff, and then that's it, once off, you know? I had a party. I needed an invite. Done, you know? I drew bears using hula hoops, and that was a great concept for my party invite, but hang on a tick. Bears using hula hoops is like the new project logo, you know, for if you use bears using hula hoops, I would use that project. I don't care what it is. But that's effectively what we're trying to do. We're allowing people who create and then digest to, you know, resend it back to the community so that people can build on it, people can use it. It's recording history. It's recording a significant part of culture that we haven't been able to track before. So that's why it's useful. Sorry.
Does Open Clip Art automatically inject the
RDF
into the file?
Yes, Open Clip Art right now, when you submit your file, is also creating the same things that you see in this dialog. So what we're doing right now is trying to get it closer to Inkscape so Inkscape can do it before sending. Just like you have F-Spot sending to Flickr, that would be really cool if you could do it from Inkscape sending to Open Clip Art. The only difference between that is you create the artwork on your camera when you're doing a spot to Flickr. In this case, you're creating it in Inkscape, so it's a pretty cool idea. And we don't know how aggressively we want to push this, because sometimes people don't understand that much of copyright, and with Open Clip Art particularly, it's public domain, so you're actually claiming responsibility for something being your intellectual property, and then signing not a license, but a declaration that you're giving it away. So this sort of means you know, if you've actually just had, you know, party sponsored by Coke and you just submit your whole party flyer and you put it into, you know, you've actually just done trademark violation. And if 200,000 people download it and remix it up and they're like, well, this person's accountable. No, I don't know how that works. I'm not an IP lawyer, but I'll tell you what, it's really messed up. We don't want pollution of the database, which is why we need a culture of librarians along with the Open Clip Art site, just in a similar way. So that's something we're trying to generate enthusiasm for. But first we need the website. On that template, that mock-up that I do, I'm currently hacking it up. I'm a big XHTML CSS geek, and I love getting it really right. PHP Towel is what we're implementing it in, so this is almost done. But getting somebody to help hack up PHP Towel to map to each one of these functionality points would be good, so I'm begging for help. But, yeah. I'd done Flame and stuff before, so I figured the Towel was kind of cool, but I didn't actually make that decision, sorry. CC Host was using PHP Towel. You know, use anything, right? If you've given a canvas, just start painting.
The license tab there, 44. Oh, sorry, not even the license tab in the document metadata was like...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Incredibly cool.
This is great. This means that if you're not publishing to Open Clip Art, you just want to put it on your blog or you just want to give it to a friend, you define here what your license is, and that's portable per document. So it's just like if you're an OpenOffice, you could save as this particular license. You can save as this license, put it on your website without somebody having to ask you. They can open up somebody else's document, have a look at the license tab, and there they've got it.
So I was going to ask if that kind of coolness could be applied to some of the metadata fields, stuff like language.
That's,
could well be dropdowns or radio buttons.
That's exactly right, yeah. And in this case, that's
author, I mean, you know, pre-populate. And if it's something that goes from somebody else and I shouldn't be able to change the original author field, that should be grayed out.
Yeah.
Sort of reinforce that.
That's really cool. Making sure that they realize exactly how closed the author intended this to be. The funny thing being is proprietary does nothing. The currently selected dot, proprietary does nothing. If you know much about copyright law or you've heard any of the Lessig talks or anything like that, proprietary is, you know, instant. Once you've created a work, it is yours. You know, you make it and it hasn't got anything else, well, then it's immediately yours. So we didn't actually put any RDF, you know, when you haven't edited this dialogue. We just start putting it in as you do. The funny thing is instead of saying none, we make sure that we say proprietary so that you know that you're not going to be useful. I don't want to put in brackets you're useless. The translation could get that very wrong. But it's something that, you know, needs to be, you know, affirmed towards people that, look, here's your opportunity to open up your work. And I believe that just from personal experience, I've had two clients from Open Clip Art, and we haven't even really done a major release. It's amazing how, and, you know, two clients in France, you know, you bill in the euro and you start to feel good. It's that sort of thing. It's that it attracts people and it gives them the credibility they deserve. At the same time, it's actually helping people and it's helping you share what you're doing. Now, I've really going airy fairy about this. Does anyone have Inkscape questions? Anyone have CC?
Just one thing to do with Inkscape and Adobe Illustrator. I do a lot of just trying out a lot of conversions between the two, and anyone have experience of how good is the SVG when you're going between the two, back and forth.
Mm. So SVG, you could interpret as a lot like HTML. It's a standard based on a spec, which means that many people who create authoring suites implement the spec differently. Different browsers implement HTML differently. The same is said for SVG. That's why compatibility between the two through the SVG format is sometimes difficult. The best thing to accomplish compatibility with Adobe Illustrator, besides tell somebody not to use Illustrator, is just use shapes. Subset your text so that fonts aren't necessary. Make sure that you're specifying everything in pixels and subset your shapes. Subsetting is bad because text loses its textiness. Text becomes a shape, which means in the XML it's no longer searchable. One of the cool things about Inkscape is we have this. We have a find dialog in Inkscape, which means if you have a particularly complex illustration, you can actually object create names for each of your selected shapes and be like, you know, awesome, you know, and then give it like a particular label or something, you know, And then you can find, based on that, you can find against all these different things, which is great. But when it comes down to doing text, this string is possible to find until you Control-Shift-C, or you actually go to the path, object to path. What that does now is that turns this into just editable shapes, which is great if you're dealing with fonts and somebody doesn't have your font and you don't care about translation or you don't care about the semantic value. You just subset. You just object to path on everything. If you're sending it to the printer, that's how this was done. It was done just by subsetting everything so that they didn't stuff it up. They did too good. They aligned it for us. But, you know, it's that sort of thing. You had a question there? No more questions about that yet. I'm going to show some how to make bling for the rest of the talk. Yeah. I'm going to make Chrome and stuff. Okay. Start up with new dialogue. Let's talk about the filter tool right now, the really cool things that we can do with the filter tool. Right now, blurring is all the rage. I danced when I successfully built the filter stuff for the first time. I actually started hugging people. It was like my birthday. It was just so cool. Yeah. Okay. So this is a tutorial that you actually can grab from Inkscape.org. I'm going to turn this off. Close that saving. Yep, you're still there. Close that saving. Yep, you're still there. Notice how I'm closing without saving? My art teacher always said that I should never do that, no matter what it is. My art teacher didn't know my budget for storage, but SVG is really small, so I still have no excuse. So when I'm... Yeah, don't do what I'm doing. Keep it. I do as I say, not as I do. What the hell is this? Okay. Here I have an awesome path. I'm going to apply stroke to it. There's already a stroke on. It's black. I'm going to give it a really large size. Oh, 90. That's way too big. 10. Yeah, that's okay. You got cap levels. You make it a bit smoother around. Oh, for people interested in data visualization, if you happen to use SVG as an output thing or you're using any vector thing whatsoever, is make sure that you have rounded elbows or you set a miter limit. If you're doing data visualization, not having a miter limit means that you could have a value that's like up here when really the actual point that you're registering is down here. It might look weird to you, and that's because it's giving you false information. Miter limit just cuts it. You set a threshold for it to cut, or you can just round it. And round is the best thing, especially when you're working at a small scale. You don't even notice it. It just fixes that little hack. Okay. So I've got a little shape here. You can click based on that. No, I'm going to convert this shape here to a stroke to path. So now this is all one path. Now I'm going to duplicate. Now Alt-D is the shortcut. You can actually go to the Edit menu and clone and create clone, Alt-D. So that's this thing here. Now I'm going to use the blur slider to blur it out a little bit. So that means that now any change I make to this thing here, is now applied to this. It looks like I've undone my shape before, but notice how that's tracking exactly what I'm doing. I'm actually going to path, object to path. Oh, hang on, I have to stroke, sorry. Stroke to path. There we go. So now every time I pull one of these things out, yeah, that one does the same. Cool. I'm going to create another duplicate as well. I'm going to delete all of my style information because that's not necessary right now. Creating this other duplicate. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give it a color. So up here, I've got green. Really bright psycho green. And I've just moved it as an offset. So right now, cool, we have this little tube thing that we can move around. That's cool. What happens if you don't want it to look so blurred? Well, I'll go back to that green shape here, because we might as well just use it. It's got the right size. Okay. I'm going to duplicate this green again. I'm going to select that offset area here. I'm going to go path, object, clip, 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 set. All right, so now I've got this. happening. So I've got this sort of 3D tubey thing, you know, happening. There's a live effect. People love the whole idea of live effects. If you're like, you're a kid and you play with layer effects in Photoshop, that seems to be like the first thing everybody does with an illustration tool. It is, I know. That and lens flares. I was lens flare Andy for a while. I'm surprised lens flares aren't along with the wet floor look in Web 2.0, you know? It seems to just be new beta, but, you know, lens flare should totally be part of that. All right, I'm going to duplicate this shape again, not there, drag it down, push it behind. So these things here, if they're uninitiated, these actually control what level your shape is stamping on. So above or below, we're manipulating the height. I'm going to blur it a tiny bit more, but because I don't want such a dark shadow, I'm going to turn the opacity down. Okay, cool, that's great. Also, if I want, I can actually make it look like it's not just 3D off the page. I can shrink it down and make it look as if... make it look as if it's actually starting down there and stepping up. So that's kind of neat. I can even apply a gradient to that base shape here, so that way it fades off because it's going further away. And now one of the cool things is, no matter what I do to this shape here, it happens here. So it's sort of, you know, the simplify command is probably the best brand relevance to Inkscape, being called Inkscape. It wasn't there when Inkscape got called Inkscape, but this is, everything is inky, you know, like you can shrink it down, you can push it out, you can melt it, you know, it's like you're working with ink off the canvas. It's really freaking awesome, especially when you don't need, you know, to be mathematically accurate with each of these points. Remember, they're a creative tool, they're not necessarily a strict set formula. I can change this thing to be white if I want it to look all, you know, gilly or something. And if I don't like Psycho Green, I can always change that to any different color, which is great for sort of like, you're all familiar with this sort of effect, you know, with Photoshop and stuff. Well, here's the different workflow for how to do it. So that's really, yeah, messy and fun and cool. Does anybody have any particular requests you want to see? You want to see wet floor look? Yeah, the tutorial for this is on Inkscape.org. It's just one of the news postings. So you'll be able to grab this on the web if you want. Also, this video. but here is something. I'm going to have to collect addresses and stuff as you're leaving, because if I find you using this in the real world, I will find you and hurt you. It's the famed wet floor look. The sort of, you know, Web 2.0, you've got your logo and you've got your text, you know, drip down, you've got the beta, you know, this gigantic thing. Just don't freaking do it, but I'm going to teach you how. Okay. First thing, I'm going to teach you the stamp, of course. We've got a star tool here. All right. You can actually change the number of corners on the star by grabbing these control points. You can set the offset and whatnot. So you can sort of create a button like this. Make sure that inside your fill area you've actually got your opacity set up. We might need this. I'm going to go to a palette that's a bit more playful for the web. So that's a Tango palette here. All right, I'm going to duplicate, not clone. I'm going to create a duplicate, Control-D, because I don't care about keeping my styles the same in this particular case. Give it a little bit of a blur, stick it behind that shape. So I've got that. I might want to duplicate this shape again. Make it really light. I'm going to convert this, so it was a star, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to do object to path. Now what that does is it gives me, control C, object to path, yeah. It gives me these editable points. Great thing about these editable points is they can be deleted. So now I've got this sort of look happening. Okay, then just drag any point on a flat line and you actually turn that line into a node handle set, so you can actually move this. Grab the gradient tool, push it down. Yeah, cool. You know, web company. I will kill you. All right. So that's really And then beta. Although, isn't it like Flickr up to Gamma now? They're just trying to be that, you know, they're like getting to Web 3.0. You mentioned Gamma. Never release, ever. Okay, so there's your little stamp thing, if you're really down with the stamp style, eh? Cool, don't worry about that. I've done a stamp last year, I remember, so forget that I ever did this part. What's really interesting is like the wet floor effect. So if we go to our edit dialog up here, edit, clone, okay, create clone. I'm just going to press the V key. There is in the object menu, you can change the orientation of it, but I'm just going to press the V key. The V and the H are your a pretty good friend for just flipping around. So V, right now I'm aligned underneath this bit of text here. But what sucks is, no matter how much I change this opacity, it doesn't look like those crappy websites. So what, which you would say is a good thing, but I'm going to show you how to do it in the same style. Creating a rectangle on top of everything else. I'm going to fill it up to completely white. I don't know why. Mainly because there have been bugs in the past when we don't use white. And I'm just going to fill down. Now, it looks like I'm making it disappear until the outer regions. Follow with me, and I'm going to show you what's actually happening. Where you see white is where the shape is going to be visible after we've performed this. So I've gone for a gradient from white to nothing just by clicking on the white shape and dragging with the gradient tool. I'm going to select both the shape and the shape within it, and I'm going to go to the object menu, and I'm going to go mask. The difference between clipping, well, we've got a clip there, a clip path, and we've got a mask. Mask respects alpha, so it respects the fact that my gradient is going from solid to not solid, whereas clip actually uses the shape as the constraints. So clip you're using the shape of whatever you've got, and mask you're using the alpha. Mask is very handy, but clip is a bit faster, and also it's a bit simpler. So if you want to keep your XML nice and tidy, you're actually, you know, doing it pretty cool. Set. All right, so I've got that, you know, moving around now. I'm going to blur it a bit because wet floor looks a bit blurred, and I actually am going to play with the opacity this time because I didn't set the gradient right. All right, so that's sort of the same effect. We can do this with text as well. We can grab text, duplicate it, flip it, put it instead, because with text, the great thing is we don't even have to do a mask. We can just apply a gradient, which there is caveats to it, but in here, I'm just going to offset this. Okay, there we are. The best thing, see, when you do a mask, you can actually set the cut point to the cut point for the reflection. Because I didn't use a mask, you're actually going to see the G appearing up behind itself. So that's going to be a bit of a problem. But the great advantage is we can now type all we want, and we've got this cool effect. I create another duplicate, drop it behind, and make it yellow. Actually give it a stroke, and give the stroke yellow. Make the stroke really big. Is the stroke really big? Is it getting any bigger? Ah, no. No, it's not transparent. What's happening is I've actually mentioned that there's no stroke in this shape here. Check it out. See? Stroke none. So that's something you're going to run into. And even I run into it still. So we're going to have to make sure that the stroke width, stroke line cap, all I really want to keep here is font family, Vista and Vera, right? I don't really want fill opacity, but fortunately we've got object opacity. Man, that looks rock. This is why I should set a mitre limit, because it really just, you get some cool fireworks happening. I can round it and it goes away. Set it down to a respectable size. I'm going to set this to 3, because I guess 3 would be fine. Give it a blur. And now I can set both the fill, which is the inside, so if I want the fill to be yellowish, and the outset. So that's cool. And also I can put it down like this, so it's sort of like, oh, it's on the floor, or maybe it's like this, you know, you got burning text, whatever. But as I edit, it gets created. So live effect. It's cool. So are we done for time? Just about? All right, I'm going to take some questions now, and that's going to be it. So a couple of questions about Inkscape, or about SVG, or about open source workflow.
The website mock-up that you had in Inkscape.
Yep.
But is there a non-manual workflow for taking that and turning it into an actual website?
Yeah. App sourcing. Yeah, so what you can do, there is actually really nice tricks you can do. You can actually specify sheets, and you can export. Inkscape can be sent instructions to export just a path or just an area or just a particular ID. So if you've got the header and the footer and everything and there's your naming IDs, you can set Inkscape to export all IDs through the command line. And that means that you've sliced up your image already. XHTML and CSS, you're going to have to deal because you're dealing with a different media. But if you've got particular outlay that you need and you're just like hacking it up to look like that particular layout, well then, yeah, you can actually export per ID, set an ID to your main groups, header, footer, etc. And yeah, you can, close to. But I totally intend for you to send everything to Pune and, you know, it'll be... okay, that's it, I think, nope.
Andy, can you comment about the maturity and future and development of Inkscape? So if I have someone ask me about, oh, why should Inkscape's not mature, it's still 0 point something, and
okay,
what's the future?
Well, Inkscape is flourishing. It currently really has no competitor. It's put on the same pedestal as Adobe Illustrator, but as I've mentioned, a lot of the tools for maintaining the integrity of your files, and also the fact that it's a plain text file format natively, it means that you're working upstream, and that's effectively its big win. Semantic, you're working upstream, and also it has plenty of powerful features like the blur filter and the gradients. It's built up a pretty solid, you know, set of evolution. Like it forked from Guild to 3D to Inkscape. It's been around for a long time, although Inkscape is quite young, and the project is actively maintained and well documented. So there's tutorials in Inkscape. You can sell it based on that. It's also fairly nice interface to use. So yeah, cool.
Thanks very much, Andy.
No worries. All right, thank you. Thank you.
Sorry to cut off the questions, but we've run out of time.
Okay, cheers.